The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Father God, you are good and you are kind, and we thank you. Be with us now. We get to talk about our job and our vocation and all the good gifts that you've given us. Pray this in your name. Amen. Thank you for coming. My name is Brittany Hartke. I teach logic classes and rhetoric classes in Pensacola, Florida at Trinitas Christian School. I teach a medieval humanities class, so forgive me if a lot of my examples that I'm going to be using are drawn heavily from the medieval period, with a few notable exceptions. That's the water that I swim in all day long. So I wanted to talk today because coming to ACCS is so refreshing in so many ways. We get to talk about why we do what we do and how we're doing what we do, and be refreshed with the, oh yeah, that's right. Like, when I'm outside of the trenches, I can see this picture and this vision, and that's what I want, and it's good and it's beautiful. Let's do it. But I almost always leave a conference thinking, okay, but what is that going to look like? Like, what is it going to look like in my classroom when I incarnate that? How? And it's one of my favorite things to think about and talk about. And so this talk is, in the trenches, how am I trying to incarnate this good life and this picture of what education is? This is my attempt. And what I really like this workshop to be about is a conversation. Now, yes, I'm going to talk at you for an hour and you're going to listen. You probably will smile a little bit. But what I really want is this to be a conversation. Like, so this is what educators are doing together. So I'm going to share with you, here's what I'm trying. Here's what sometimes works. Here's what has seemed to work. Here's my experience in the trenches. I'd really like to hear all of y'all because I come with a certain set of gifts, a certain personality, which equips me to do certain activities, but you come with different ones. And so it's not like, here's the formula for success in making a lifelong learner. I just don't think that exists because education is too personal. And so this workshop would fail if you went back to your classroom and tried to be just like me. Or this class would also fail if you go into your classroom and don't do anything, right? So we've got to be doers. We've got to be doing something with the information that we're given. So I'm going to paint a picture for you about what I'm doing, and then hope to hear from you either the rest of the conference or in years to come. Here's what I'm doing. Here's how we're cultivating lifelong learners. I love the beginning of the school year. It's my favorite. Because you sit down with your lesson plans and your scope and sequence. You just breathe deeply. Yes, I have a great year planned. It's going to be glorious. I get to take my students through this text and through this assignment. Oh, and I just can't wait to show them this next thing. And I teach in a small enough school that I've taught the same students over and over and over again. So I taught them in fifth grade math and seventh grade writing. So by the time I get them in eighth grade Tradidio, I know their taste and their interest. And then by the time I get them in 11th grade Tradidio, we've been around the block. We know each other. I love that because I can look right at the student and say, I can't wait for you to you're going to love it. That planning process at the beginning. I have all my goals and objectives. I want students to engage and wrestle with the text that I'm giving them. So, you know, how am I going to do this? What's this going to look like? I want them to cultivate lifelong learning, and a lot of that has to do with cultivating virtue. So when I'm thinking about the school year, how can I cultivate virtue? How can education and virtue formation go hand in hand? What am I going to do in the classroom? One virtue, I try and pick different virtues for different school years, different classes that I know I'm going to have, because you can't do them all. We wish and we hope and we try, but I found it's more helpful if I narrow down. All right, what is a particular virtue that I want to be cultivating this year? And so for my rhetoric class, I teach 11th grade, it was humility. Because they're about to graduate, and they've been given a lot of knowledge. And Proverbs says that knowledge puffs up. I don't want that. It's not true. It's not good. It's not beautiful. It's not God-honoring. And so I'm thinking with my class, how can I cultivate humility in them? That's what I'm looking for. For my eighth graders, they don't have enough knowledge to have the same ditch that the 11th graders have. They think they do, don't get me wrong, but it's not the same. And so for eighth grade this year, I focused on gratitude because I didn't want them to take for granted the things that they were getting, and I didn't want them to even hate the things that they were getting. And so an emphasis on gratitude. So as I approached the year, I thought, yes, here we go. Then I meet the people, like, and plans don't always work out exactly how you want. So I've oriented this talk around three assumptions that students bring into my classroom that are directly in conflict with my goals for them. Then I want to talk about each of those assumptions, what it requires of me to overcome that difference, that tension, what it requires of my student to overcome that tension, and then probably like the bulk of the conversation is going to be, how do I shape that? How do we get there? What am I trying? What am I doing? How is this messy thing called education looking in my classroom? So the first, so the assumptions, see if I can remember them without my notes, that answers are better than questions, that accuracy is better than beauty, and that education is synonymous with school. So let's start with the first one. Let's talk about answers are better than questions. As soon as you use qualitative words like better, you automatically assume that the reverse is true. So like by saying that answers are better than questions, and I'm saying that's a false assumption that students have, then immediately in our minds we think, then questions are better than answers. No, don't go there, okay? Because that's just not true. We believe that there are true things, and to ask questions and never answer them is not faithful. So I don't want to hit that ditch on the other side where I'm creating skeptics. That's dangerous, and we definitely don't want to go there. But can you imagine with me, have you seen in your classroom the student who, tell me what I need to know, I'll memorize it, I'll remember, and I'll tell you on a test, let's move on. What do I need to know? Just give me the facts. Give me the facts. You ask me the questions, I'll give you the answers, we're good to go. This is how the classroom works. Y'all know what I'm talking about? Okay. I hate that. I hate that for so many reasons. Let me make sure that I don't wander too far from my notes because I can chat. Let's start with first what it requires of me, because I'm fully aware that what happens in my classroom, I'm responsible for. And so if I want change, if I see that there's a problem, I know it needs to start with me, and then we'll trickle down to my students. And so I would want to start with me. What do I need to change? What does it require of me? The first thing is patience. Patience, because it takes time for students to follow a line of inquiry. I'd much rather just say, hey, here's the question you should be asking, here's the answer you should come to, let's move on to the next question. Come on, let's go. We got curriculums that we need to get through. We got this stuff. That's really good for me, right? I'm good at asking questions. I've been practicing for years and years and years. And so I'm just, I can ask the question. I know the answer. I can drive you to it. That's much good for my students. And they don't need to watch me show off all the, like, here's my fancy question, here's my really Christian answer. What I need to do is be patient and let that line of inquiry develop naturally. Now, notice what I'm not saying. I'm not saying I ought to be passive. Let inquiry happen. Let them wonder about whatever it is they're interested in. No. Eighth graders don't wonder about the right things. And so I'm engaged, I'm guiding, I know where I want, the questions that I want to get to, and I can drive the classroom in that direction, but I need to be careful not to drive too fast. a lot of this talk, I'm going to draw heavily on David Hicks' book, Norms and Nobility, which was revolutionary in my thinking. Like, oh, this is just a beautiful intellectual treatise about why I'm doing what I'm doing. And he says this: the activity of learning takes place in no man's land between what the student can accomplish and what he may not be able to accomplish. This fact sets up a creative tension in education to which both students and teacher must become accustomed and responsive. Right? This requires patience. But there's this tension where the student's like, ah, I can't do that. And you're like, well, give it a minute. I think you can. And drawing them to the place where like, wait a minute, I can. I can do that. So patience, that's the first thing. The second thing is, I guess, granting my own frailty, that provocation is a messy business. Provocation is a messy business. And so it requires me to get messy. Sometimes you walk into the classroom and you think, I have the paradigm of discussion questions. Like, this question is going to bear eternal fruit. Like, I just can't wait. And you walk in, and you ask the question, and the students look at you, and then they look at each other, and they look back at you, and the looks on their faces are like, we really want to give you what you're looking for. Like, you know, they can read in your vibe that they're like, this is a good question, and we just don't get it. And like, we really like, there's this compassionate stare. It's like, we really want to give you what you want, but we don't have it. And you're like, well, that was not a good discussion question, because my people aren't discussing. It's nothing to do with the question. It's all about to do with the humans, the souls that are in front of me. But then sometimes you walk into a classroom and you make an offhanded comment, like, I don't know, do you think Jane Austen believes in love at first sight? And the students are like, and they're all talking with each other, and they like start fighting, and they start diagramming on the board when they think who fell in love with who, and it's, you know, they're engaged and they're thinking about it. And I mean, they're 11th graders, or I think that was 12th graders actually. They're 12th graders, so they're also thinking in terms of like, how do you fall in love? Like, what's that going to look like? And so they're not applying it to themselves in the classroom, but they are in their heads. And so, you know, Jane Austen comes in with this interesting perspective, and the, you know, something that I just said offhand leads into the lunch table, right? We all like sit together and lunch because we want to keep talking about it. And the next day I have parents of the 12th graders like, hey, so last night at the dinner table we were talking about, they're like, oh, I didn't plan that. Thank you, Lord. That's a kindness that he just gave, because my students were engaged, my students were interested. The second thing, well, I guess it's the third thing, is modeling. Modeling that questions serve an important academic piece. I'm going to quote from David Hicks again. He says, the state professional educator argues that mutual learning implies equal ignorance. Mutual learning implies equal ignorance. He substitutes classroom preparation and teaching technique for knowledge and error. I'm compelled by culture, by even my students and their parents' expectations to have all the answers, right? As a teacher, I'm supposed to have it all. God forbid I'd walk into a classroom and see something I don't know about. But I'm becoming more and more convinced that this approach paints the wrong picture of education. This doesn't paint what it looks like to be a lifelong learner. If the teacher isn't curious, if the teacher isn't wondering, why should the students? Right? Am I setting them up to think that answers are better than questions because of the way that I'm interacting with my material? I'm providing them answers and answers and answers, and nary a question, unless my question is assessing if they've understood the answers. And so I need to be modeling in my classroom this lifelong learning, asking my own questions. There's a distinct difference in my mind between asking a question and asking my own question. Does that make sense? So I can ask a question that's a good question to be asked, and my students need to wrestle with the answer. Or I can ask a question that I genuinely have about the material. Can any of you help me understand why Dante is so silent in Paradiso? Can you make sense of that? Like, that's different from the way he interacts in the other books? How is that significant? How am I to understand it? So that may be a question that I genuinely have that the students can then cooperate with me to come to some sort of answer, some sort of a framework at least, because we're going to be reading Paradiso for the next 3 or 4 weeks. And that question I want them to be in their head so that when Dante does talk, now his words mean something different. Like, oh, wait a minute, he's been quiet, quiet, quiet. Now he's saying something. Let's listen. So trying to take my own genuine questions. What does it require of the students? What am I looking for to cultivate in them? Two things. Humility. Humility to admit they don't have all the answers. Right? To ask a question means you don't have all the answers. That can be embarrassing if you're in eighth grade. It can be embarrassing if you're a teacher. Anyway. Second thing is curiosity. It requires curiosity of them because they need to be engaged enough to ask questions, which doesn't seem like it would be terribly novel. Like, oh, if you're in class, you ask a question. But I'm not, someone raises their hand and you're like, inquiry, curiosity, praise the Lord, and yes, can I go to the bathroom? No. We are too busy. this sort of like, I want to engage them in this curiosity sense so that they're not even raising their hand to ask me the question. They can't help because it just bubbles out of them. They're like, wait, but what about this? Sorry. that moment where they're like, okay, I'm past, I'm not supposed to do that. I try to encourage those moments because those are genuine. Those are feeding the classroom. That's feeding the culture. Like, that's a great question. I wonder about that too. And then I need to keep my mouth shut and not answer it, right? Because I want the other students to be working to answer. So the other part of curiosity is not that I just want them to ask the question, but I want them to pursue an answer. Right, because we worship a God who is truth, we know that our questions have answers. And I don't want students who are just like, well, I wonder about this, and I wonder about this, and I wonder about this. That doesn't, whatever, inquiry for inquiry's sake. I want them to be pursuing answers to the best of their ability, and that's where I can come along and guide them through. How do I shape this? How do I go about doing this? First, we practice discussion. Now, my entire classroom is set up typically reading a text. Either I'm reading it to them, and I'm using the word text on purpose because there are many different types of sources that we read. If any of you have been in some of the postmodern, careful about the word text, I'm using it on purpose, so hopefully I won't be in too much trouble later. But as we're going through, looking, I'm reading or they're reading, and then we stop and we ask questions along the way. We discuss. I might say, oh, did you notice how he used this word? And we might talk about it a little bit. I rarely, rarely lecture in my classrooms. And so to put me behind a podium is just very strange. So for eighth grade, I'm walking around the classroom. Like, they're sitting in a circle usually, and I'm walking around. Right? So if I'm higher than all of them, they're sitting in cushy chairs like you. And I'm walking around. I can see things from up above because you need to be able to see what eighth graders are doing. Right? So, I want them to feel like there's never a place in the classroom that is not mine. And so I'm walking around, although it's not my spot. Like, this is my home. Please come in. You are welcome and invited guests. But it's my turf, okay? And so with that, I can require certain standards of behavior and things. With my 11th graders, though, they've learned to govern themselves. And so I sit amongst them. I sit in a circle with my book open, and we read together. We're co-laboring. So that's a picture of the classroom that I'm trying to cultivate. And so most of the classroom is discussing conversation. But the people are bad at it. And so I designed in my curriculum particular discussion practice. So I send home weekly readings with students that we come in the classroom prepared to discuss. And so Wednesday, with the eighth graders, we read chapters of Mere Christianity. And they come in and they bring an index card of their questions. Because I want them, as they're reading, to not think, I've got to understand this. I've got to master it. I've got to know this. That's stressful. And they're not actually going to listen. And so I've tried to change their perspective on that reading and say that What do I wonder about? What don't I understand? And they bring their question, and they ask each other the question, and I try and keep my mouth shut as much as possible, okay? Because I want them, like, they'll ask a question, and they'll look right at me, because I'm the font of all answers, you know? And so it's the training of, don't look at me! Look at your classmates. Look at the person who just said that. You know, someone will say something, and they're like, is that even right? And they'll look right at you. And you're like, I would start talking to them about it, right? And of course, I'm there to protect them from, you know, tragic heresy or something like that. But that sort of process, we practice. With 11th grade, we do it with City of God. Send them home with 40 pages-ish a week of City of God. And then we come in and we discuss it. And there are tons of questions. We talk about, like, we're practicing this. Like, this is a skill that you aren't naturally good at always, and so this is something that we're doing, that we're practicing. In 11th grade, bring in questions the same way we practice this. In addition to Augustine poetry, so for 11th grade, I'm going to talk a lot about poetry and how I use it. I found it to be an incredibly useful tool and kind of new to me. So this year was revolutionary in the school year for me, because I was like, I got to learn poetry. Like, I had been forced to write poems here, there, and do sorts of things. I didn't like it. It wasn't my thing, because I used to think that you could say that about education. Like, it's just not my thing, so that, you know, it's just not worth my time. And so I was like, no, this poetry, I'm gonna write poems together. I'm gonna work on it. I'm gonna understand this. There's something beautiful about it that's beyond me, and I gotta do it. You know, so I'm getting in the trenches with the students. Now, students don't know that I'm walking in like, I don't understand this, and I don't like it, right? No. So I'm like, poetry's great. And then we figure out why, and then we're writing it together. And I found poetry discussions remarkably helpful, because there's something mysterious about them. So when somebody, you know, interprets a poem or reads it a certain way, there's usually seven or eight other interpretations of that same phrasing. And so one of the students, really? You thought that? When I read that, I thought this, 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 because of this, this, this. Really? Whoa! And so it helps them learn this charity of other ideas and listening to one another. And so I found that to be a great training ground for discussion. Next, accuracy is better than beauty. I don't mean that beauty is better than accuracy, but that they each have their place. That there's something about beauty that is Christian, I guess. Something about pursuing something that transcends, that speaks to truth, but beyond itself, that it points to other things and references other things, is incredibly powerful. But we live in such a data-saturated society that my students, like, want me to prove it to them. Like, give me the scientific evidence. And they know better than saying those words out loud their mouth. But so many times, the questions that they ask and the way they interact with me proves to me that's what's in their head. Like, they're just like, okay, but did it really happen? Like, did Beowulf really pull Grendel's arm? And, you know, really did that happen? So we have conversations in the class between that which is true and that which is actual. That something can be true and not always actual. Did Dante actually go into heaven? Did he get caught up in heaven like the Apostle Paul? Like, did that actually happen? Did he actually have this vision? Is this actually a dream? I try to, like, discourage those questions entirely. Right? That's not the right question to be asking, because it's not a science textbook. It's true. And so there's this messy business of, I want to put this into categories, and me pushing my students out of those categories that they've put themselves on. So then how do I go? What does it require of me? How do I go about shaping this idea that beauty is, I almost said beauty is better than accuracy. That's not true. But how do I go about making beauty true, making beauty academic even, I suppose? First, modeling, right? We've got a model in front of our students. I know, isn't that beautiful? I want to show them that beauty matters. And so how do I go about doing that? I make sure my room is tidy, my classroom. When I invite them into my classroom and they walk in the morning, good morning, come in. This is an extension of me and you're invited. And I want my extension to be beautiful and orderly. And I'm going to be careful about this might be a little overboard, but this is helpful to me. I'm going to care about the littlest things. I'm going to make sure that if I'm drinking tea in the morning, that my mug doesn't clash with my outfit. Because I want the aesthetic experience when my students are looking at me and like, oh, well, that's nice. I'm also careful about the whiteboard marker that I choose. Right? So if I'm wearing a blue jacket, I'm not going to write with a black marker. And because that would be awful. And so I'll make comments about this as we're in the milieu going about the thing. All right, I gotta write a note on the board, which I don't do very often either. But I walk over to the board and there's a scattering of colors. I'm like, I'll do black because it'll look better. That way you guys have a beautiful experience when you get to look up here and they laugh at me and whatever. But I want them to see that beauty matters and those little things too, because it's good to be beautiful. And so I'm going to put beautiful art, surround them with beautiful things, help them to understand that sort of beauty doesn't apply to only in the classroom, right? There should be this awe of all the beautiful things that that God has done, and that there's beauty in that which transcends us. Again, it requires of them humility. I'm looking for them to think about the ungraspable beyond them. To be beyond them. So there's something else out there that's worth your attention and worth your imitation. You're not the center of your own universe. Surprise! And then charity. I'm also looking to cultivate charity in them. Because it takes charity for a black and white mind to understand the difference between true and accurate. They have to be willing to listen to something that isn't accurate. That can be difficult. And so I often will encourage my students, sayings that we have with our different students. And the one I probably use most frequently is be charitable. Right? So be charitable to the texts that we're reading. Be charitable to someone else's interpretation of it. Right? So if your classmate says something you think is ridiculous, as one of my students, I say be charitable, don't I? Yeah. Listen, right? So there's this close connection between charity and humility. How do I shape that? All right, so I've talked to you about writing on the board. So when I think about the classroom, setting it up, I put some effort into things like I'm a tea snob. I love drinking tea, loose leaf tea. In the South, they all drink sweet tea. I didn't really know you could order sweet tea at a restaurant growing up. Grew up in the Pacific Northwest. Came down and, like, everyone's like, loose teeth look like you're drinking leaves. And, did you just get that out of the garden? Yeah. Yeah. And so part of my mission is inculcating drinking of hot tea in the South. So on Mondays, we have tea day because Mondays we sit around and we're talking and I don't assess anything. And so I invite the students to bring in their own mugs from home and I give them tea and they're able to drink tea if they want, right? There's something about leisure and beauty that goes together, which I think we'll have to save for a different conversation. But when we read Dante, we set up the chairs in a circle. Now, most of the time my chairs are in a circle, but when we're doing Dante and students walk in the room, I'll say this repeated phrase. All right, it's Dante, so we need to be in a circle. And it takes them about 2 weeks to figure out, like, how cool that is. And that's all I say, right? Today we're reading Dante, so we need to be in a circle. And then you get that student who's like, circle. Right, and then this is me, like, sometimes it's the students like, to me, that's part of the beauty of this environment that I'm cultivating. I don't want to separate it. When we read Beowulf, read it by candlelight, which is very dangerous with eighth graders, I know. So it takes much prayer And we light candles, turn off all the lights, and we read Beowulf. Then at the end, we blow out the candle, and we talk about it in the dark. I have no idea. I'm not talking about to them why we're reading it in the dark, why we blow up the candles, right? It's for the kings to seek it out, and everyone else is like, this is cool. We're going to read in the dark. Who gets to read by candlelight? And I'm hoping by the time they're 45, they're like, that's why we read Dante in the dark. Whoa. So my classroom and environment that I'm shaping is part of my agenda towards an appreciation for beauty. Second is this matching of form and content. Particularly eighth graders in the logic stage, they want to separate form and content. So you can have something that's perfectly good in content and slovenly done. And that's fine. And I understand the dialectic and rhetoric difference, that there's this emphasis on a beautiful production. But I can require my eighth graders to write legibly. I can require them to stand up and give a speech with the right form. So we do speeches of praise and speeches of blame in eighth grade. And so we talk about getting up there, and there's an appropriate way to give a speech of praise, and it's not, Alfred the Great is really great. In fact, he's the greatest, pretty much the best. If you're going to write something as lame as that, you really got to sell it. And so he's the best. He's absolutely the best. He's the greatest. And so we talk about that. We practice. And they're not good at it at first because they're so nervous. They have to get up and they have to read their manuscript that they wrote and in front of their friends. And what if it's bad? And what if they misspeak? And there's all this complexity in their thinking. But I want to be pushing them towards to be good. The form and content ought match. When you do your scripture recitations, if you're, you've ignored punctuation, your form and content don't match. And so we have this conversation with them to help them see that those two things have to work together. You can't just have good content. That's insufficient. Art. I'm not an artist. And I'm learning to appreciate art. And I've been reading books to help me understand, like, the technical sides of art and interpretation. And so, along with my students, been pushing them towards art. Because there's something that you can capture in art that you can't capture in any other way. And I want them to see that. And I thought the best way to have them see that was to have them do it. And so, for my 11th graders, I required an art project to prove they understood the themes in Song of Roland. And an art project that they had understood the themes in Paradiso. And it was very broad about what was like allowable. So you could write a poem, you could paint, you could sculpt, you could do a pencil drawing, you could just memorize a passage and do a dramatic monologue, you could write a skit, you could take a photograph. But what it had to be accompanied with was a why, an apology. Like, so I had a student sculpt an oliphant, and I sculpted it, and this is why. And I had students who did pencil drawings and switched from graphite to lead and were able to articulate why they chose a certain medium in a certain way and how they used color. And I had some beautiful poems, and it was just the geometric roses, like the mixture in Paradiso of heaven as a celestial rose and heaven as like an amphitheater, like joined together in one image, is beautiful. It was beautiful. And there was something as they're talking about it, like they were able to articulate and understand in this new way. And I'm sitting there crying. I just love it. It's so fun, so fun. And I think it was so satisfying is when I told them they had to do it, they're like, pale and big eyes, and they're not going to say, seriously, you're going to make us do that, but they're, oh, okay. And then they do it, and then it's glorious, and then we're celebrating together because we're able to talk about things on a new level, and it's beautiful and so exciting. Eighth graders are not quite ready for that sort of, here you go, on your own, think of something, right? Because my instructions to the 11th graders were literally the ones I just told you, like, show me that you've read the book and that you'll understand the theme. Go! And so they did all the work of it. Eighth graders need a little bit more help. And so we do a lot of illustrating. On almost every test or assignment, I have them illustrate something at the bottom, take what we've talked about and illustrate it in a certain way. For 11th grade, well, I think I have to talk about this later, so I'll just say that. The eighth grade, we illustrate a timeline together.
we have like 30 minutes of extra time on Fridays. And so I was like, what does a teacher do with extra time? She reads fairy tales. So I sat down with my students, and we would read The Princess and the Goblin, just bits and pieces every, after we'd finish our chores, sit and read together. And as we're reading, I'm having them draw a picture of a goblin. And so as we're learning more and more about the goblin, their drawing has to change more and more, right? So the first time they start drawing a goblin, they put toes on it. Well, if they turned in a drawing of a goblin with toes on it, they're not really listening. And so when they learn they have no toes, they're like, oh, no, I've got to start over. I put toes on the, you know. And so having them do that, having them illustrate the circles in Dante as we're going through. Sit down. This is your study guide. Can you, you know, illustrate the circles together? Can you understand what's happening in the poetry enough to put it in picture? And then I love this question. I mean, I love it and I hate it, but almost every year students will say, they should make Dante into a movie. And then I illustrate it. And then I, oh, well, you can't really put that into, see, you can't. You can't put it into a movie. And then art appreciation, having them study different pieces. We took our students to on a civics trip, and I got to go, it was my first year last year. I got to go to Washington, D.C., and so studying the different art that we were going to see, making them memorize, talking about it with them. It was so fun to watch them in a museum or talking with them afterwards, because there's something, like, comfortable about recognizing something. And so it was so satisfying, like, well, we saw it, you know, when we did the slideshow and all these things. But when we got to see it in person, it was so much better. Why didn't you tell me, you know, that Reuben Zalen the Lion's Den was that huge? I stood at it for 45 minutes. And I'm thinking, I don't think I've ever looked at anything for 45 minutes. I'm like, praise the Lord. Like, I wish I could have the patience to look at something for 45 minutes. But I'm just moving on. And so watching them, like, learn this appreciation and take pictures with their cell phones of little tiny pieces of it, right? So, like, here's a detail that we couldn't see when we were looking at it in a book, but now in person we can see and we want to think about it and we want to talk about it. And so we did this preparatory work for them, and then when we got back from the trip, we sat down and talked about what they had seen, and we'd given them a few particular assignments in the museums to work on, and so they're reporting on their experience. It was just delightful. And I think that's one area that I'd like to grow this coming year is use art more in my classroom, not just for our trip. And so I use art to help to teach the Renaissance and things, but even in the medieval, I want to do a better job of incorporating art in the classroom, because I think that holistic picture is glorious for them. Same thing with music. I teach the students Gregorian chant. I teach them some medieval ballads. I teach them Genevan psalms, because not only are these the songs of our people, medieval ballads are, you know, everyone needs to learn at least one good drinking song, bring us in good ale. But these are the songs of the faith for the most part. And so singing the Lord's Prayer together and a Gregorian chant, singing it in Latin together, you know, that integrative discipline, that's what we're supposed to be good at. And so we try and practice. Teach them some medieval dances. We have a medieval festival, which, if I have time to talk faster, which I can do, believe it or not. teach them dances, right? There's something about this beauty of a dance that's good. And then listening to symphonies and preparing them to go to symphonies. We had a glorious experience in Washington, D.C. We got to go see Mason Bates, who's a modern composer, they performed one of his violin concertos, and the violinist who performed co-worked on the piece with him. And then we were sitting there in the whatever program they gave you, which, you know, advertises for everything. There was a piece of paper that had, you know, a afterwards talk with the, there's a clever name for it, it escapes me now, but afterwards talk with Mason Bates, he was there, and one of the students, like, looks down the road at me, he's like, are we going to this? And I was like, I don't know what it is. What is it? And I looked at it, and I was like, oh. And I was like, do you want to? And he's like, yeah. And so it was so neat. Like, so we took all students, we had to stay and listen to the conductor, the composer, and the violinist talk, and then answer some of our questions. And it was just neat that, like, to talk to someone who's doing it now, and like the heritage and like influences that were on him and how he's applying principles of music. It was just a cherished experience of ours. And then finally, poetry. I emphasized poetry, particularly the writing of poetry, in 11th grade. But, you know, we're all classical school teachers, so we fill gaps wherever they have them. And so the gap that I have often filled is 5th grade math teacher. So I'm really good at fractions. And that's about it. And so at the end of a math test, I would, I'd ask the students to write me a poem. I'd give them a write me a poem about rain. And they're like, this is math class. And I was like, yeah, would be great to do it. And so they start doing it and practicing, and it becomes a thing. At the end of assignments, I usually give them a poetry prompt and expect them to write something. And then if it's particularly glorious, either the student or I will read it to the class. Sometimes they're not glorious, but we all get a good laugh about it. And if everyone's finished with the test, then I start on the whiteboard, start writing a poem, and usually I make a riddle, so they're trying to figure out what the poem's about. And I'm, you know, marking stressed and unstressed syllables, and I mean, I'm practicing. They don't know this, but I'm practicing because I'm not good at it. And so they're working together, and how do we do the rhyme scheme? And I'm marking it up, and they're like, why did you put that tick up there like that? Why are you marking that? It's math class, and I get to talk to them about poetry and integrate all of this stuff together. For 11th grade, I have them do poetry presentations. They study different George Herbert poems, and they analyze the structure and themes and present to their class. We studied the four quartets together, the same thing. They took chunks of it and had to give presentations. And then we actually studied love songs. So I had them bring in what they thought was the best love song, music video included, if appropriate. And so that was fun to take what that we've been talking about in poetry and moving it into something that they're going to listen to on the radio or something that they're going to encounter. And like, how can we pull this together? And that ties in with the next point that the next objection students have, where I'm trying to, how can these two things, how can the world interact, school and home? Then I make them write a courtly love poem, and then actually a Christian love poem. Like, what are the differences as the two different types of lovers? What kind of poem are you going to write? We read much poetry in the classroom, from Dante to Spenser to Milton to Shakespeare to Chaucer. So they're exposed to translated poets. And then English poets as well. So try and like inculcate them in this poetry, that there's something beautiful that can be communicated best in poetry. At the end of the year, one of my 11th grade students wrote me this, and I found it encouraging, so I thought I might share it with you. He says this: at the beginning of the year, I heard you say one of your goals for us was to cultivate a love for poetry. When I heard that, I thought, no chance. Me too. I never enjoyed poetry, and I didn't think that it was possible. But after this year, after reading Dunn and Frost and actually trying to write poems with varying degrees of success, I have found that poetry is actually quite enjoyable. I had the same transformation with art on the aesthetic strip, having never taken the time to appreciate art until now. So as we conclude this year, I want to say thank you, Ms. Hartke, for expanding my horizons and challenging my worldview. That's what it's about right there, right? Those little souls that are moving just one step closer, taking them to a place where they are like, I don't even know if I can go there. I'm pretty sure I don't want to. That's what we get to do. The last objection that students have when they come into my classroom, objection, that's not the right word, assumption that they make, is that education is synonymous with school. And I realized I was, you know, talking to people about this, and that was when they were like, I don't understand what you mean when you say that. And I was like, oh, I'll explain it. It'll be fine. And so what I mean is that we want there to be two worlds: our school world, where we do this thing called education, and our home world, where we do this thing called pleasure or leisure or life or whatever it is. But we want to separate the two, that what I learn in school shouldn't affect the cartoon I watch when I go home from school, or the snack that I choose, or whether I wash the dishes, or if I help my, like, those two things are separate. So at school, I can do this, But then at home, I'm going to do this and think this way. And so give me an academic text, and I can talk about it like an informed Christian. Give me SpongeBob, and I can enjoy it like a pagan. Like, both of those things at the same time. That should not be. But there should not be a disconnect between you're reading the City of God, and you're talking about the difference between living like a Christian and living like a pagan, and then you go home and you watch SpongeBob like a pagan. So how do you make sure that those worlds match? Like, fear the same person, that you think the same way, that you, if it's possible, watch SpongeBob like a Christian. What's that going to look like? That's the question, and that's the tension. And the huge problem is I can control, right, this environment. This is my school, my classroom. You come in, you rock in your chair, I'm going to put you on the floor. Like, I can control that. I have no control over here at all. And so what I'm doing over here while I have the control can't be, here's my rules, follow me, do it because I said so. Because that's creating the hypocrite, right? That's the, I can obey here and then I can please myself over there, no big deal. Because really, I'm pleasing myself in your classroom because I don't want any conflict, I just want an easy life, and so I'm not gonna ruffle your feathers. I'm gonna please myself in both places. I don't want self-sovereign. And so what I need to be doing when I have the control, when I have the boundaries, that's a gift that God has given me. That's a privilege that I have. And so I'm responsible to be actively wooing them towards Christ, towards the gospel, towards truth, towards beauty, when I can control the environment. I don't want them to obey me because the consequences are so bad, right? You know, 11th grade. 11th graders feel like they have to obey you. It's just nasty. I want them to be, we're moving in the same direction. So of course you're going to be following me because I'm taking you where you want to go already. And if they're walking beside me and we're going in the same direction, then their other side is going to look the same as well. Because it's real, it's genuine, and it's for them. And so this education, this virtue formation that we're doing in the classroom should spill out of the classroom. So when I'm saying that education is synonymous with school, I'm saying that there's a tendency for students to disconnect the two. That the virtue formation I'm getting in school is glorious and good and praise the Lord, but don't make me live that way. More often it's laziness rather than rebellion. Right? They're just falling back into what's easy and comfortable rather than willfully, I'm going to disregard all the Christian teaching you've given me and now serve myself. They're not usually that self-aware. So the question that I need to ask is, what does it require of me? David Hicks says, classical scholarship inhabits the classroom and the open air, the drinking parties, and the playing fields. But that's what I need to convince the students of, that classical scholarship inhabits the whole of you. Everything you touch, everything you do, everything you think and say, classical scholarship should touch. Don't disconnect them. I need to get into their world. I need to get into their world, and I need to woo them. I love the word woo because, well, hardly anyone uses it. And it's just fun to say. Say woo. Yeah, and you can say it for a long time. As long as you have breath, woo. There's just something satisfying about the language of it. And it's foreign enough that when I say it in my classroom, it strikes my students' ears as like, that's weird. What does that mean? It's not like something they've ever heard before. And so I'm on this mission to woo them to beauty, to woo them to love of poetry, to woo them to love the medieval, which can be a difficult job. And so I need to be in their world wooing them, right? I need to have them into my home. I need to be taking them out for coffee. I need to be going to their games. I need to be going to the piano recitals. I need to be amongst them. Because if they see me as isolated in the classroom, well, I'm feeding the classroom is one way, outside life is another way. And so I want to be in both of their worlds. I want to be their teacher in one world, their friend in the other, and then pretty soon I get to be their friend in this world too. And so I want it to all be connected and living amongst them. And it's crucial that I'm imitating Christ in both worlds. Because what I want is the Bible to be true. It says that when a student is grown, he'll be like his teacher. And I, gosh darn, don't want them to be like me. I want them to be like Christ. And I need to be filling myself with the Word. I need to be praying for them so that I'm considering them and thinking of them as Christ thinks of them. And so my call to for them to come over here, be like me, really is, don't be like me. Be like this guy. Right? Be like Christ. Imitate him. Imitate me as I'm imitating Christ. Asking them to follow in my footsteps like that. And part of it is they need to know me. I need to share myself with them. There's two ditches, and I have fallen in both of them. The first ditch is being too familiar with your students, that they're your buddies, they're your friends. And so being in their world means being like them and like, oh, I want them to like me. That was my first year teaching. It's like, yeah, I'm so fun. And then my mentors helped me see that that was not faithful. And so I hit the other ditch. Like, I am your teacher. Greetings. And again, mentors were like, woo, you hit the ditch on the others. I'm good. I'm really good at doing things. And so you give me instructions and I will hit the ditch for you. Like, oh, find it. And so, like, there's an appropriate balance, right? And that's what we're always navigating as teachers. And there's a different balance in 8th grade than there is in 11th grade. It just, it changes. And I can't imagine what it would be in 2nd grade. And thank you, the Lord, that he hasn't asked me to. So I want to share myself with them. Like, a tea snob, admitted tea snob. I want the students to come into my world about that. Love essential oils. So I diffuse them in the classroom and give house points if someone can guess the scent. Like, isn't this fun? This is what we do so much. I want them to know the books that I love to read. And I want to be able to, you know, make a comment about a book in the classroom. Like, oh, well, you know, I read The Book of the Dun Cow a couple years ago for the first time and my world changed forever. And so now if I make a comment about it, oh, you would love it. You should read The Book of the Dun Cow. I'm getting everyone to read. Y'all should read The Book of the Dun Cow. It's revolutionary. And then read Chaucer. Well, maybe read Chaucer first, then Book of the Dun Cow. Yeah, do those. And then it also requires me to love my students, which we smile and nod. Yeah, love our students. But then we see them. And then we have to correct them for the same thing every day. And there are a lot of days in the school year. It's really hard to love them then. This goes back to the praying for them, imitating Christ. I need to think of them like Christ thinks of them. And so I need to be offended by their sin and love them and woo them. That's my job. That's my vocation. And for some reason, God has been fit to trust me with it. I wouldn't. Goodness gracious. That is a high calling that we have. And I think it's so important to see the connection between education and everything else is Christ. Christ holds us all together. And me loving my students is terribly, terribly important. Again, it requires humility of them to grow. They have to want to be changed by their studies. What students learn should affect them, but they need to want to be changed. And the humility to apply, encourage even sometimes, to apply what they've learned in the classroom to the outside world. Think there's something you should do about it. Right? James says, don't just be hearers of the word, only be doers. He said that because it's so much easier just to be a hearer. Doers, that takes so much work, so much thought. And so even that sitting at this conference, that's the same temptation to us. Be hearers of the word. Yes, we nod. Yes, yes. Let's cultivate virtue. Let's cultivate humility. Let's love our students. But we need to be doing something about it. It needs to be active. I love coming here with my colleagues because they're hearing all the same things, you know, so we can help keep each other accountable. Like, remember, we're supposed to be doing this. Thank you for telling me. Yes, I needed to hear that again. All right, what do I do about this? How do I shape this dual, false duality deconstruction? Whew, I like that. I ask them the question often, what are you here for? I put it at the top of a test. I ask them to name themselves on a test, and then what are you here for? And students, when they get to that, they're like, is there a question? You know, they look at it like, do I get a grade for this? How many points is that worth? Right, and that's the forbidden question is, do I have to know this for a test? Am I getting, that's a forbidden question. So they ask it, and then they just get the eyebrow. And they're like, okay. You know, and so because they're like, okay, I know she knows me, so do I say what I ought to say? Do I say what's true? You know, there's this tension, this moral tension in their mind. Praise God. And that's what the question is there for. I want it to be in their minds. What are you here for? And if you write down that you're here for to cultivate virtue, which sometimes they do if they've been catechized enough, and oftentimes I think it's genuine, then that should require something of them and should change the way they approach the rest of the assessment. Like, if you're here to cultivate virtue, well, then get going because you have 2 hours to take this test. We'll talk about the test in just a moment, but they're trying to be purposeful about making them tools to cultivate virtue, in addition to testing for understanding. But sometimes they write, I'm here to get a good grade. I'm here to get a good grade so I can go to college so I can be successful. Some of them write, I'm here because I have to. Some of them write, I'm here for fun. I'm here to learn stuff. You know, all sorts of things. And it's just so interesting. Like, there's not a right or wrong answer. It's just helpful. I know the heart of my students. What are they willing to put on a piece of paper? I've learned something about them, and now I'm in their world, and they don't even know it. It's like, ha, ha, ha. Because now I know where you take them. Where are they? Where am I starting? Where are we going? So keeping it in front of their minds, I find commonplace books where they're looking for beauty outside of the classroom. They have to do all the work of a commonplace book outside. They have to collect quotes from books, quotes from media sources, I allow them to do quotes from one movie or one song. So I want them to see that beauty isn't just in old books. Right? Like, beauty is in the world around them. Go find it. And when you find it, grab it. Write it in your book. Remember it forever. Cling to those things. I make the 11th graders write reflections. They have to sit down for 20 minutes and write a reflection. That's the instructions. And so you get everything from, okay, in class we talked about this, and you asked this question, and I didn't quite give an answer, but here's my answer to that question now. So you get the student who just needs a moment. I just need to process. And then I'm getting beautiful things from them after, but they're not able to, like, necessarily give that sort of thing right on the fly when I ask the question. And another student is able to. And so reflections like that. But I also get reflections like, Star Wars. All I can think about this week is Star Wars. For 20 minutes, like, whew, I'm in their world, and I know my student, and I know where I need to take them. And so I use these tools to interact with them, engage, making them think about something on purpose. And most of the time, it should be about school. They have this pressure of, here, there's something that interested me in class that I want to think more about. They're glorious. Parent involvement. You got to get your parents involved. I ask weekly questions to the 8th graders. They're called them flat questions. They're designed to get parents to engage with material with students because I can imagine this scenario. Sit down to dinner. Dad asks son, what did you learn today? And son says, nothing. And dad says, what am I paying them for? Or like, okay, whatever, the conversation's over. Moving on to something he's more interested in. So thinking, all right, how can I equip parents to ask a different question, to get a conversation started. And the trouble is, my parents haven't read Beowulf. My parents haven't read Augustine. And my parents are fond of saying, I can't help them with this. I didn't get that. I don't know that. Okay. Let me help you. And so the questions that I ask usually require some sort of biblical perspective on the class, but it goes beyond our class discussion. And so usually the student has to articulate part of, like, the context, and the parent informs the other way. So questions like, why do we read old books? How can you apply Treebeard's counsel, don't be hasty? I love that one. How are you like Augustine? All right, so the student has to tell mom and dad, Augustine's like this, this, and mom and dad can say, well, you're like this, and you're like this, and help them to see their own reality and interact. I invite parents into the classroom. There's an open door policy at our school, which is terribly unhelpful because when do you come when someone says, come over anytime? And so what I try and do is whenever I'm starting a new book or starting a new topic, I'll send home a note to parents. Right? Monday, these times, would be a great time to come to class. get a little vocabulary. This is where we're going. This is what we're doing. Get on board. Just get the introductory sort of thoughts. And I've had success. The parents that are going to come, come. Parents who aren't going to come, aren't going to come. And so making a lot more particular invitation seems to be helpful. I want to talk about outside gatherings. Terribly important. So I teach medievals, and this year I didn't make it to Anselm's Proslogium. And so I was telling students, I'm really sorry, we're not going to be able to read Anselm's Proslogium to eighth graders. And they're like, oh man, that's too bad. And I was like, so let me tell you kind of what it's about and just kind of summarize. I'm sorry, you're going to miss this. And one of the students was like, well, can we just read it for our Bon Livre? We have an outside reading program. And I was like, shh, no, no. It is too hard for you. No way. If you were going to read that, then you all would have to come out to my house and we'd have to read it together because there's no way I'm letting you read that alone. And the students were like, really? We can come to your house? We can do that? And I was like, oh yeah, I guess we really could. You really want to? And they're like, yeah. So one Saturday, I had 7 out of 18 eighth graders come out to my house for 5 hours, and we read Anselm's Proslogium, and we ate pizza and drank root beer floats and had a wonderful time. That's the picture. That's the goal. They couldn't have read it by themselves, and so we're doing it together. Taking students out for study groups, and I give a final exam. All right, everyone, meet up in there at 5 o'clock. I'll help you study for 2 hours. Let's talk about the material. Having them out to my house. I'll make y'all dinner. Come on. We'll come out and study together. Have a glorious time. Cooking together, inviting students out to cook. Trying new things. I had the senior class out right before they graduated, and we made fresh pasta together, right? So most people don't get to make fresh pasta, and so it's this novel, like, really, we get to, like, crank it out, and you're like, yeah. It's just super fun to laugh and to be together, and we were, like, listening to Italian cooking music, which there's a Pandora station called Italian Cooking Music. At the top, you know, we're singing along with whatever sort of Italian songs we almost know together. I want to end today talking about assessments because I think they're really powerful. I try and use my assessments to get to the heart of my students in a different way, asking them personal application questions. Like after we study Eusebius and the martyrs, how do you think the Son of God goes forth to war differently as a result of studying that? And most of them are like, I don't even do that. Right, and you need to. I mean, when you're singing a song about the martyrs and their blood that was shed, and then you're learning about its historical context, there should be a connection. Make them take a narrative test. I made students take a drive with Augustine and defend things that they would see just in our culture, and a YOLO bumper sticker. What would Augustine say about that? How would you explain it to Augustine first? And then what would he say about it? One of the students was like, Ms. Harkin, you do know that I have a YOLO sticker on the back of my car, and now you're making me change the way I thought about everything. I'm like, sorry, no, I didn't know that you had a YOLO sticker in your car, but you better think about it. Like, do you have that on purpose? I sent my students to a wedding on one of their exams, this 8-page packet. Soundtrack included of all of the songs that interact with at a wedding, and like, is this fitting, and talk about the roses. How would T.S. Eliot talk about the roses? How would Augustine talk about the roses? And how would Dante talk about the roses? Because next time they go to a wedding, I want them to see the roses filled with significance. This isn't an arbitrary flower at a rose. It's on purpose. And so want them to engage in material that will, When they see a church, they're going to think about it in a certain way. When they see a rose, they're going to think. When they hear that song, Jesu, Joy, Man's Desiring, is that a fitting song for a wedding? Well, we hear it all the time. We don't ever think about it. If you look at the lyrics, and you're like, is that a fitting song? I think that's a question that we can ask and we can go forward. Let me leave you with this. I often approach the classroom with wrong assumptions as well. I approach with the assumption that my students want to be lifelong learners, and they're just sitting there waiting, tell me how. But a learner needs to want to be changed by his studies, and that's not always the case. We don't get those students And so we're called first to teach them to be learners, show them what it means to be lifelong learners. We approach each school year armed with faith and hope, knowing that we're merely planting seeds for the kingdom. Thank you.
Y'all go enjoy your lunch.